This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, Fiji's new government hits back at former PM Frank Bainimarama, who alleged the new administration was acting unconstitutionally.
Mr. Bainimarama has now made it more than clear that he rejects the idea of government and opposition working together.
Meanwhile, a holiday surge in sales has the Solomon Islands business community upbeat after riots and COVID forced some to the brink of bankruptcy.
After the COVID, everything just, there was a big, huge turnaround. So I think that you will be still seeing us in the long run.
And we find out why more than half of hospitals in the Pacific are at risk of losing services due to extreme weather events. All that and more today on the show. I'm Kyle Evans. So glad to have your company. But first, for the first time, a woman is in the running to become the Governor General of PNG. Former High Commissioner to the UK and prominent women's leader Winnie Kiap has become the first female candidate nominated to the post, along with two men. And though the post is not political, commentators say it could mean a lot for gender equality, as Belinda Cora reports.
The other two male candidates for Governor-General are both former politicians, including the incumbent Sir Bob Dadai and former Manus MP and senior lecturer in law at the University of Papua New Guinea, Mrs. Stephen Pokawin. Unlike them, Winnie Kiap does not have a political background, but head of PNG's Institute of National Affairs, Paul Barker, says she might still have a strong chance considering her experience as PNG's High Commissioner to the United Kingdom for more than a decade.
Someone who is highly regarded and a professional, clearly knows the functions and the systems of government, but doesn't engage directly in politics, but sustains the reputation and the standing of the office. That person would have a very positive influence on government.
Though PNG's Governor-General acts as head of state for the country, the office is ceremonial and does not have any direct influence on governor matters. They instead act as a PNG representative of the British monarch, who is currently Charles III.
It also has the role of being responsible for daubing and issuing the New Year's and the country's independence honours and awards, and the Governor General is invited to a variety of functions where he or she can give speeches, and although they're not allowed to be political speeches as such, they can be influential in terms of promoting good causes like education, environment, social issues, and so on.
Ms. Kiap's strong background away from politics could be an advantage. And Mr. Barker says, as Governor General, she could help address issues faced by women in Papua New Guinea.
And if they were able to pursue some good causes, but without being participating in politics, and including as a woman, helping raise the status of women in society, but also within leadership roles, that would be an immensely positive influence within PNG.
Barker says although the position may not be political, Parliament MPs are the ones that vote in the new Governor General. That can mean politics is often still at play.
Most of the Governor Generals have firmly stayed outside politics. Although there was, as I say, one former Governor General who had difficulties, a conflict of interest, if you like, and reluctance to actually comply with a direction to remove an office holder, and as a result of that, there was a constitutional crisis, and he lost his office. But other than that, Governors General have basically stuck to their function of being the representative of the crown in the country and not participated in politics. They're not allowed to, but they have in the past sometimes pursued issues of national concern, but in a cautious manner so as not to tread on political toes.
Former MP Dame Carol Kiddo says the historic appointment of a female governor general would help get issues important to women a higher prominence in Papua New Guinea.
If I were there, I'd be taking on the cause of education for community level, you know, mass education. How do we get our people educated? And I'm quite sure if Winnie Kiap does win the vote, she will have some causes that she would want to take on and promote from that very powerful position of being the Governor General. And I think just the whole image of having a woman there at the head is very much needed in hoping that the vote will go her way. Of course, Stephen Pokuin is a fine man too. But the thing that she has that he doesn't have is that she's a woman. You know, both of them have experience in dealing with politicians or have been politicians themselves, etc. So I'm not denigrating any the other candidate, but I think Papua New Guinea needs to have that image of a woman at the head.
Dame Carol, who had a 15-year career in politics, says that negotiations are probably underway by candidates trying to use this office to their advantage. But she says a female governor general would be a massive milestone for Papua New Guinea.
And so she has all the requisites to do an excellent job. And so I'm hoping that the men on the floor will recognize that. And if she's put there by the men, that will be a statement in itself. As we know, our present Prime Minister is completely refusing to consider any form of affirmative action for women to go into politics. So perhaps, you know, it's time to have a woman there at the head of state would be very good, because we've seen time and again that it's not a level playing field. Women can't get into politics competing on the battlefield as it presently exists. And I don't see that battlefield changing in the near future. So it's still going to be a real struggle for women to actually get inside and be a voice in Parliament. I'm very pleased now that we have two women there, but we need 22 or more. We need a lot of women. We need, you know, a sizable percentage, 10% of the parliament.
But gender aside, could Ms. Kiap fulfill the role of Governor General effectively? Mr. Barker says her wide range of experience means she should have what it takes.
The candidate that we're mentioning, Winnie Kiap, has got immense suitable experience and knowledge in these fields, and certainly knows the responsibilities and knows how those responsibilities are distinct from the political responsibilities. So, and as an educated woman who's gained high office in the public sector, she certainly would be in a strong position.
Parliament will meet tomorrow to officially announce the nominees and begin the process of electing a new Governor General. All three candidates needed to be endorsed by at least 15 MPs of Parliament to validate their intention to contest for this office.
That was Belinda Cora in Port Moresby with that report. Fiji's new government has fired back at claims made by former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama, who spoke about unrest in the country and alleged the Rambuka administration was acting unconstitutionally. In an address to the nation on Friday, new Prime Minister Sitivani Rambuka criticised Mr. Bainimarama's comments.
I explained that the governing coalition, the People's Alliance, the National Federation Party and SADALPA, wished to develop a positive relationship with him and his Fiji First Party in Parliament. Mr. Bainimarama has now made it more than clear that he rejects the idea of government and opposition working together for Fiji. He has chosen instead to walk the same path of arrogance, aggression, and provocation that he walked in the last 16 years. And that has prompted me to address you this afternoon, responding to his remarks. In recent days, Mr. Bainimarama has been bombarding the country with lies and misinformation. He alleges that Fiji is in some sort of crisis, that our new coalition government is engaged in repressive, oppressive conduct. Families are said to be living in fear of job losses and going back to the dark ages. We want him to explain what he means by that. Mr. Bainimarama claims multiple Fijians have approached him for assistance, presumably to deal with what he calls the deteriorating situation He may not realize it, but his words portray a perfect picture of the way he ruled our beloved nation for 16 years. Fiji became the South Pacific's first dictatorship of the modern era, the complete antithesis of our coalition's approach to governance. We have a government for the people and by the people. Our parliamentarians are their servants, servants of the people. This commitment is central to our political philosophy, and I accuse Mr. Bainimarama today of attempting to create instability and chaos, which he can then attempt to exploit for his own nefarious ends. He has also tried to sabotage our coalition's assumption of power by vigorously advising permanent secretaries, other civil servants, and those serving on various boards, organizations, and independent entities not to resign and to oppose the will of the People's Coalition government.
Shortly after his speech, ABC reporter Lithe Mavono spoke with Sitavani Rambuka.
Well, the basic aim of making this statement today was to rebut the allegations and the misinformation that he had put out publicly and also on his party's social media pages. The people have the right to be informed of the alternate views, particularly the views of the government they voted into office.
There have been comments, some from some NGOs and other people, saying the comments that he made were insightful, the kind of comments that in the previous leadership people would have been charged with something for. Will you be bringing charges against?
Yes, or not bring charges. The charges are brought by those who are responsible for prosecuting people. We can submit our reports and they will be investigated. And if they warrant the prosecution attempts, then they will be done by the rightful authorities.
Do you think it was insightful and inciting violence and could motivate people to violence?
Not what I personally think. It's what the people think. And we have enough complaints or concerns raised, then it must be taken up by the government.
So Frank Bainimarama has made reference to instability and spoken as the former commander of the RFMF. People are anxious as to the support he has at the camp. Can you reassure the nation as to the support you have at the camp?
I do not want to undermine the position of the commander. That is his prerogative. And nobody has any right to claim any support in that organization.
We are clear that the People's Alliance volunteers and staff were working in the Prime Minister's office without proper appointment. If you can just have a clarification on this.
Every administration coming in would have interim appointments, helpers, and so on. And when an instruction comes out from them, if they're going to be occupying the positions, if they're acting in an interim capacity, their signature will have the appointment AI at interim.
That was Fijian Prime Minister Sitavani Rambuka speaking with ABC reporter Lithe Mavono. Pacific Beat. It's time to take a look at all the big news from around the Pacific region this morning. And joining us to do that is Evan Wazuka, who is sitting in the chair that I've been pretty familiar with for the past 6 months. Evan, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Carl. Great to be here on your first morning morning presenting Pacific Beat. So happy to be here.
So the wheels haven't fallen off yet, but there's still a little while to go. Good New Year's, I take it?
Yes, excellent New Year's here in Melbourne. And looking forward to what will be coming up this year from the Pacific.
Excellent. So first up this morning, a large earthquake was recorded in Vanuatu last night. What's happened?
Yeah, so this story has been attracting plenty of global media attention. This morning, my Facebook and Twitter feed was full of alerts about this earthquake in Vanuatu. So according to Vanuatu's meteorological service, a 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck just 72 kilometers northwest of Luganville at around 11:30 last night. Now, this was a shallow earthquake, and it occurred at a depth of about 27 kilometers. Now, due to its size and the velocity of the quake, a tsunami advisory was issued, but it was later cancelled. Vanuatu's Met Service say there was no destructive tsunamis observed along the coastlines of Sanma Province, Panama, and Malampa.
Yeah, interesting stuff. And were there any damages reported?
Well, nothing significant has been reported so far, and from the coverage I've seen, But in Santo, there were reports on Facebook of a strong tremor lasting about 30 seconds and the power going off. So although this is the first earthquake felt in the area, that's like a strong earthquake for quite some time. Vanuatu isn't a stranger to earthquakes. You know, it sits on the Ring of Fire. So earthquakes do happen from time to time.
No, you're right. Not a stranger at all. Live volcanoes. It's a fascinating place over in Vanuatu. Now let's go to Samoa, where a week of fasting and national prayer has started.
Yeah, that's right. So the government of Samoa is starting the new year, right, it says, with a week of fasting and prayer for the country. The Samoa Observer newspaper is reporting that an annual service was held by the National Council of Churches to mark the occasion. It was attended by the head of state, the deputy prime minister, and members of cabinet. So these type of events, Kyle, are relatively common in the Pacific, especially to mark the new year. In fact, over the weekend, we saw in Fiji where the new government also had their Thanksgiving service. They had it yesterday afternoon. It was held in this big auditorium in Suva. It brought together the coalition party members and MPs that make up the new government. There was also lots of community members there. From the photos I saw on Facebook, it was quite a full house, lots of people there. And I guess it's politically important to have those parties come together just to mark the start of the new year. And also, this is the first Thanksgiving service they've had together since the elections in Fiji towards the end of last year.
Yeah, fantastic. It's an exciting time of year and full of possibility, as we know. And finally, let's go to the Cook Islands, where there's a shortage of staffing with the police. What's happened there?
Yeah, so the Cook Islands News is reporting that the police force is facing a staffing shortage. It's a problem they've had for some time. According to the police spokesman, a recruitment drive was supposed to have happened last year, but that wasn't possible due to shortage of funds. And they're saying they need up to 15 officers to fill in gaps within the police operation. The police say they haven't had any recruitment since 2021. And even that recruitment was the first done in several years.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'd really be interested to know as to why that is exactly. How have they coped with the shortfall so far?
Well, one of the interesting things that the Cook Islands News is reporting is that over the past year, they've brought in new staff, but out of the 10 staff they've brought in, 3 were not Cook Island residents, or they were brought in from overseas to fill in the gaps. So this year, the police force is hoping that they can actually get that local recruitment drive underway and then bring in some local talent, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. You wouldn't think there'd be a shortage of applicants with a career like that, but I guess we'll wait and see. Evan Wazuka, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you, Kyle.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
It's Monday, January 9, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. I hope you all had a great and wonderful New Year and are settling in seamlessly back at work. I know I am today. Still to come on today's show, we'll find out why the Solomon Islands businesses are feeling hopeful this holiday season. We'll also unpack speculation around the departure of the now former Fiji Rugby Union Chief Executive John O'Connor. Then we'll look into why more than half of the hospitals in the Pacific are at risk of losing services due to extreme weather events.
Tune in to SBS Samoan News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoan News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoan News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
Solomon Islands businesses were dealt a double blow with riots in 2021 and COVID-19 lockdowns forcing some to the brink of bankruptcy. But a surge of customers over the holiday season has many hopeful, including the country's Chamber of Commerce, as Kristen Reader, Amanu Leong reports.
Jackie Molea Chow remembers how violent rioters burned many of the stores around her JJ's baby shop to the ground just over a year ago. Her store was spared, but the business still took a big hit.
It was really tough for us because we were not able to actually go to the shop and move this stuff from where we were. And it was like, it was in the heart of the riots. So we were just like praying and hoping that they wouldn't break in and steal all our stuff.
The November 2021 rioters targeted shops like Jackie's in Honiara's Chinatown. More than 60 buildings were destroyed. As a result, the central bank reported a massive 90 million Australian dollar loss to the economy. And just as Jackie was picking up the pieces, she faced another hurdle.
When we started to like improve in our business and then the COVID hit during that time, we didn't have sales for like 1 to 2 months. And so we thought of closing down the place.
But Jackie didn't want to give up. She relocated the shop away from Chinatown and stepped up her presence online. The decision paid off.
It was quite good Christmas sales because we had a draw thing on Facebook. We were thinking of closing down, but then after the COVID, everything just, there was a big, huge turnaround. So I think that you will be still seeing us in the long run.
And it seems Jackie's experience isn't unique. Solomon Islands Chamber of Commerce surveyed more than 100 businesses to check their level of confidence in the market. Simama Nielsen, the Chamber's Membership and Services Officer, says the results were significant.
Majority of survey respondents, which was 60%, felt that there will be improvement in the next 9 months. And this is a significant change and improvement of over 32% compared to the November 2020 survey, where only 28% felt that there would be improvement.
That low confidence reported in 2020 was likely due to the COVID-19 pandemic and the uncertainty on the private sector as a result. But now, Ms. Nielsen says things are looking up.
Now, you know, with the reopening of our borders, more projects coming in and the SB Games, there seems to be more certainty from the private sector of the general business situation improving compared to the past 2 years, which is, I believe, a good indicator.
And with profits expected to rise, Solomon Islands' economy could also grow. And that's given businesses like Nahara Clothing Shop the confidence to reopen in the once busy Chinatown. Emma Taylor is the manager.
In the Christmas season, we have many customers coming compared to after the riot 2021. We don't have any customers at all because all the shops are burned down and we also closed down the business. But this Christmas, we have many customers, and so we make lots of money. This year will be better than last year, because now that many people know that Chinatown is open by, I think that's really good to see that some businesses are still open and that Chinatown is not closed down altogether. Just want to encourage other businesses in Chinatown to come back and open their business.
Emma Taylor, manager of Nahara Clothing Shop, ending that report by Kristen Reader, Amanu Leong in Honiara. Fiji Rugby Union Chief Executive John O'Connor has resigned after 6 years in the role. Mr. O'Connor said on Friday he's stepping down for personal reasons, but there's plenty of speculation after the CEO took extended voluntary leave last year while the FRU carried out an internal audit following the dismissal of three senior backroom staff. Mr. O'Connor is also a cousin of former Prime Minister Frank Bainimarama, and some have questioned whether that may have played a role in his departure. Reporter Marion Farr spoke with Colden Kamea and former member of the FRU board and publisher of the Te Vovo Rugby Online magazine about the developments.
Well, he cited personal reasons, and I've since been told that it's due to health, for health reasons. John's not been 100% lately, and a lot of stress, a lot of responsibility with Fiji Rugby, and I think it's taken its toll a bit, so he's decided to step down.
Do you think that his family links to Frank Bainimarama might have also played a role, though, given the outcome of the recent general election?
Oh, one could speculate, but I don't think so. I think Fiji Rugby Union, you know, is at arm's length to all of the politics that's gone on lately. I honestly don't think so. I think John's really has got to take care of himself. He's been one of the better CEOs recently, insofar as the many CEOs that we've gone through in recent years. John O'Connor has done a fantastic job for Fiji Rugby. You know, we've had our disagreements, particularly with the board and chairmanship of Rugby Union in Fiji, which is, you know, very linked, as you mentioned earlier, linked to the Prime Minister, who decides who's the chairman of the board, and who also, you know, has a great interest in rugby in Fiji. But under that situation, I'd say that John has been one of the best CEOs that Fiji Rugby Union has had over the years.
I'm sure he'll be missed in many respects. But Mr. O'Connor's replacement, Davita Tuiloa, is already director of the FRU board. He's also the principal accountant and auditor with Fiji Revenue and Customs Service, which would suggest that he's been brought in to take a look at the books. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Davita is a long-standing rugby man. He's been involved, you know, from an administrative side, and he's quite young, with Suva Rugby Union for at least 5 years, Suva being the biggest rugby union. And Davita has held a number of administrative positions with Suva Rugby Union, so stepping up to Fiji Rugby Union. It's good, I think, for the future if he continues to be involved at some level. He's a very highly qualified guy, very smart, very intelligent, very well qualified, and he'll bring all of his smarts and experience in finance to the table, which can only be good for Fiji rugby going forward.
From a rugby perspective, would you like to see Mr. Tuiloa stay in the role of CEO more permanently?
Oh, good question. I don't know whether he wants to. You know, he's a very senior guy in the Inland Revenue and Tax Department, and I'm sure he's, you know, looking at that. I don't really know. But I think they've just asked him to step in really more as a director, as a more senior person looking down and just keeping it all a bit of a level playing field for, you know, there must be at least three guys in the Fiji Rugby Union management who could apply for the role and do a good job of it. And Saleh Sorabaki, he's been acting as CEO a few times recently. He's the son-in-law of Frank Bainimarama, but, you know, it's a small world, small country. So everyone's related to everyone, no matter which way you cut it. But, yeah, I think Davita is good for the interim. And then whether he wants to continue in that role, I don't know. But, you know, I'm sure he's going to have a think about it.
Well, we will have to wait and see how it all plays out. But for now, I'm sure there'll be many people thanking Mr. O'Connor for everything he's done for Fiji Rugby and wishing him the very best with his health, and also wishing the new acting CEO all the best in the interim taking over this role. Thanks so much for your time today, Calden. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That was Fiji sports pundit Calden Kamea speaking to Marion Farr about the resignation of Fiji Rugby CEO John O'Connor. More than half of hospitals in the Pacific are at risk of losing services due to extreme weather events. That's according to a new report published by Georgetown University in Washington, which looked at 78 hospitals in the region. It found that the proximity to coastlines and rivers of many of these put 63% of the Pacific Islands population at risk of losing hospital access. The author, Eileen Natuzzi, an epidemiologist with nearly 20 years' experience working in the Solomons, joins me now. Eileen, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Not a problem. So, yeah, it sounds like pretty concerning stuff. And you've called for a change in the way hospitals are viewed in the Pacific. Why is that?
Well, I think that hospitals have always historically been seen as health. And development partners don't really want to invest in health. I think they see it as sort of a difficult investment to keep track of, to see what the results are. When we move hospitals out of health and see them as infrastructure and look at them as critical infrastructure, then we may get somewhere in shoring up this acute care that is needed throughout the Pacific Islands.
Now, you mentioned that 63% could be at risk of losing services. What kind of services are we talking about?
So these would be people who would lose their hospital services. Many of the atolls have one hospital that serves the entire atoll or serves that atoll plus a chain of islands adjacent to it. And when people come to the hospital, they come with infections, they come with injuries, they come with chronic diseases, you know, heart attacks, strokes, and whatnot. So they would lose those services if the hospital is damaged. Let's say a cyclone comes through and destroys the hospital. Not only is the ability to care for those who are injured from the cyclone lost, but also the ability to treat any of the diseases that are endemic to that community, like malaria or dengue, hypertension, and whatnot.
Wow, so these aren't specialist services. These are just your most basic services that you'd expect from a hospital.
Yeah, these are basically acute care services that any hospital should be able to provide. We're not talking about, you know, complex neurosurgery or, you know, advanced orthopedic surgery. We're just talking about what serves the community, the hospitals that serve the community, that delivers babies when there's a complicated pregnancy. You know, all of those sorts of things, you know, dialysis, if dialysis is offered at that particular hospital.
And how immediate of a threat do you think this poses? Have we seen much disruption to services already as a result of climate change?
Well, I think yes, I mean, in the report, I kind of broke down hospitals based on ones that were actually damaged that had to be relocated after being damaged and moved inland and up in elevation. There are hospitals that have already, you know, the governments have been proactive that because they know that they're looking at severe damage. And then, you know, the hospital that I know best is the National Referral Hospital in Solomon Islands. That hospital gets bashed repeatedly with floods, with storm surge and whatnot. And everyone in Solomon Islands, in particular the staff at the hospital, know that it needs to be moved. It needs to be relocated to higher ground and inland. So these are real effects that are happening. And adaptation is a real thing that needs to get more funding and more priority because this is the real time issue in the Pacific Islands.
Yeah, you mentioned that bashing and storm surging, and that was going to be my next question, is exactly how that disruption is being caused. Is it this ongoing threat of sort of flooding and inundation? Is it erosion? What is it, I guess, specifically about the extreme weather events that poses such a threat to them?
Yeah, it's kind of all of the above. Look, there are some hospitals in Tonga that are built on a coastline, and when a cyclone comes through, that hospital is just literally blown apart. Storm surge certainly is a problem. King tides can be a problem. Tsunamis are a problem. Just rising sea levels when hospitals are built, you know, at an elevation of 1 meter to 1 to 2 meters above sea level, you know, they're potentially looking at inundation, gradual inundation of the coastline. So it's kind of all of the above. And then throw into that what isn't necessarily climate change, but is part of the region, and that's earthquakes, seismic activity, and how that can also damage some of these critical infrastructure buildings.
This is Pacific Beat. I'm speaking with Eileen Natuzzi. She's an epidemiologist, and we're talking about some of the extreme weather events that are really threatening hospitals in the Pacific at the moment. Eileen, so does this mean a lot of hospitals will need to be moved to higher ground, or are there other options that are strengthening the resilience, perhaps?
Well, yeah, you have to kind of work with what the geography is. So, you know, some of the atoll islands hospitals, they have no place to move. So they go up. They get built on stilts. They, you know, build up 2 or 3 stories so that their valuable equipment, records, and patients are in the upper levels. So if that atoll is flooded, then they've adapted to that. Other locations, the hospital can be moved, needs to be moved, but the funding isn't there. And, you know, rebuilding a hospital is an expensive investment for many Pacific Island countries. And that's where loss and damage from COP27 can be very helpful in changing the attitude towards hospitals, you know, for all of the development partners to address it. So I think it can be done stepwise. I think there are some hospitals who have already been, their countries have already adapted, and those are great examples to look at. Just moving to the Atlantic in the Caribbean, in my paper, I mentioned People's Hospital in Tortola, British Virgin Islands. It's a beautiful example of a hospital that was well adapted because it's located in what's known as Hurricane Alley. That hospital was subjected to two Category 5 hurricanes in 1 month, and the only damage it sustained was cracks to the windows when the community around it was completely destroyed. So the design of the hospitals, what is being taken into account to make them stand up to cyclones, to move them away from inundation as much as possible, it's different, I think, in different locations because the geography is so different where these hospitals are located.
That's unbelievable. A broken window from two Category 5 cyclones. I've lived through a Category 5 cyclone in Cyclone Debbie, and yeah, it was one of the most harrowing experiences of my life. I know what damage they can do. I suppose just looking at other areas, do you think aid partners have neglected this area in some ways?
Yes, I think they have. And again, I think because these hospitals are seen as health as opposed to being seen as critical infrastructure. Critical infrastructure is getting more kind of attention these days. And, you know, part of critical infrastructure is airports, roads, you know, bridges, ports. And that all makes sense. You want to move goods when you're dealing with a natural disaster. To get to people, but you also need to be able to treat people. And so hospitals are now considered part of critical infrastructure. You know, at the UN meetings, the UNGA meetings recently, there's talk about changing the vulnerability scale or index so that it doesn't use gross national index as one of the measures or metrics. That eliminates a lot of the Pacific Island countries because they don't meet that GNI requirement. So we're changing the way we view the need to fund adaptation based more on vulnerability. But we need to push that even further. And I think that the Pacific Islands is really sort of ground zero for redefining how we fund vulnerability and adaptation.
And Eileen, just one question before we go. I mean, how soon do we need to see a change in strategy regarding this issue? Does it have to happen pretty much immediately?
Well, I mean, do we want to wait until a few more hospitals are trashed or do we want to be proactive? I hate to be really frank here, but hospitals are being damaged. And as, you know, storms come through the Pacific, cyclones come through the Pacific, as the seas continue to rise, and they're rising at three times the rate of the rest of the world in the Pacific region, then I think we need to get on the ball. We need to start funding, aid and development partners need to start prioritizing funding, rebuilding these hospitals.
I think a lot of people would agree with you there, Eileen. That's all we've got time for today with you today, but thank you very much for joining us on Pacific Beat.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Eileen Natuzzi, epidemiologist and report writer into the threats that extreme weather is posing to hospitals in the Pacific. As the son of popular musician Shazi, Jaro Local certainly had big shoes to fill. But now he too is among the most recognised names in Pacific music. On a recent tour of Australia, he spoke to the ABC's Caroline Tierman about his inspiration and his path in music.
Well, I'm a easygoing fella. Like, I just do my music and, mind my own business and still working on music. But I started in music with my dad because he was a musician himself. I was born into music, I should say. And then he planted the seed way back when I was still a kid.
And your dad being?
Oh, my dad, my dad is Shazi.
When you were growing up and listening to your dad, is that what you wanted to be like?
I never really, it is a problem nowadays in the islands. Like, kids growing up, it's not bad, by the way, but, you know, kids growing up, not knowing what their ambition or what they want to become when they grow up. But, yeah, for me, I never really know how to do music, but I guess it was there because I grew up around people in music. Like, my village is called Namaruka in White River, and we have little rasters there. Obviously, my dad, apprentice band, my uncle. So I was around music the whole time growing up. So yeah, I guess I'll excel in that. Even if I got any other job, I still love to do music. So I love doing stuff like involving music, like surrounding music. So yeah, my passion is just helping other artists so that we can push through the market. We can see how all of us excel in this industry. So I mostly do things just surrounding music.
Jaro, what do you write songs about?
So every artist or songwriter has different techniques or different inspiration on what they write about. Me, I always write about my life. Like, it helped me go through a certain situation or certain problem or whatever is holding me back in a way. So I just write about it. Yeah.
You've been performing around the Pacific and internationally for some time now. Tell us about what your experiences are playing in front of huge audiences.
I mean, yeah, we've come a long way. And every time the level kind of goes up, you know, the crowd, the stage, and the artists that you're performing with. So I always get excited and happy about we are leveling up in some way. But yeah, performance-wise, it's like every performance is just like the first one. Pretty happy.
In 2016, if you went solo, what was that like? Like writing and doing music on your own?
So I didn't like actually made up my mind to go solo. It's just because of the location. So in 2016, I became a dad, so I had to move from my area, my village, to another location. And Ozlam and Tukijus was closer to where I lived back then, in 2016, when I moved. So I started going to the studio, like their studio, because it's much closer and much cheaper to move around. So that's when I started doing my own work. But then with the help of these two brothers, Ozlam and Tukijus, we kind of set up a new sound, not a new sound, but a new vibe coming from the islands.
You also took out the Song of the Year and South Pacific Artist of the Year. What was that like?
Oh, yeah. I remember it's in PNG for that UMFM Awards. It's kind of a big deal in PNG because, you know, the music industry in PNG is very, very active. I love PNG people when they see their local artists. They actually, like, you see the respect and looking up on those big artists. So, yeah, with that award, it was kind of a big deal for us, me, Ozlam, and Tukijus. And I always see it like a springboard, you know, always getting us to the next level. Also happy back then. I'm still happy now, but at that moment was like we deserve this.
As I said before, that you also perform internationally, and right now you are in Melbourne. This is not your first time to Australia, is it? Tell us about performing in Australia or New Zealand or other parts of the world.
So I just say, you know, you have to be around good people, like you all share the same vision and the best interest of the artist, like people who helped you. Like, they see what you are looking at. So touring-wise, it'll come because there's a lot of artists in the islands. Like, for us, touring in Australia, New Zealand, and all this, like, it's a big deal for us, you know, coming from Solomon Island. So, yeah, my hit song, the song that I got an award for, the Dakini Tangarare. We did it. I did it with Chris Young under Shoreline Studios. That's my uncle Eddie Fitty's studio production. In 2017, and it's been 5 years, but the energy is still the same. I give back the same energy as I get on stage.
That brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. Have a fantastic day.